Good morning and welcome. It is good to see everybody here. As it has already been mentioned, that this morning the elders have desired to address the congregation after the morning service. And of course, we recognize that there is only a certain amount of time we have between the AM assembly and the PM assembly, and most of you like lunch. So we're going to try to keep this brief this morning for the purpose of lunch, so that you can have lunch afterwards and the elders can address us. So that gives me an opportunity to present a shorter lesson. And this, in this case, it's not one of those persuasive sermons that's going to get us all up and we're ready to go out and do stuff. This is a more an intellectual exercise to answer a question that was presented. At the beginning of the year, the elders gave us our goal as our theme for the year was to go and teach. And when that theme was presented, one of the questions that was asked to me was whether it was okay to do anything to bring somebody to Christ. Specifically, it was stated that somebody had used this as a defense for instrumental music in worship, said this is a great way to bring people in so that they will become Christians. And I have seen that as a practice. I have seen where, we'll get mail and somebody will send us this flyer for a Christian concert, and it's got the laser lights and the smoke going, and it's, you know, this is a way we get people to come in, and then maybe we'll convert some of them. And the question is that okay? Well, if we go within the scriptures, we're not going to find an easy answer for that, because the Bible's not going to talk about, is it okay to use instrumental music to bring people to Christ? There are other issues with instrumental music. We're not going to deal with that. Let's get to the core of the issue. It's right up there. Does the end justify the means in regards to evangelism? Is it okay to do whatever it takes as long as it ultimately saves one soul? And that's a difficult question because, you know, you would think if it saves a soul, how could it possibly have been a bad thing, right? Well, I only have a few minutes, and we're going to spend most of our time in 1 Corinthians. But before we do, I want you to consider something Jesus said in Matthew chapter 23, which I find very interesting in regards to what the Jews were doing in their time. And the Jews, they have the old law, right? They are following God. They're believers in God. And they have decided there is no other religion in the world that's right except for ours. And they're right in that regard. At that time, Judaism was the only right religion. And so these Jews were going out as far as they could to convert people to Judaism. And Jesus says something very interesting about all of their great effort. He says in verse 15, he says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you travel around on sea and land to make one proselyte." That's somebody who is converted to Judaism. "And when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves." And so he says, you went out there to go convert somebody to Judaism, and rather than converting them to God, they're in worse shape than they were before. And what this brings up to us in this regards to do the ends justify the means is that we don't always know what the end actually is. So we might say, well, look, we brought all these people to Christ, and really you have to stop and say, have we? Consider if there is a church that has rejected God. Now, I assure you, that church will not say, we are the church that rejects God. They will never do that. They don't know they've rejected God, but sometimes in our ignorance and in our foolishness, we reject God. So there's this church that rejects God in its doctrine or in its practice. If that church is growing, has it done a good thing? It may seem like it because, look, we're growing. But you really have just increased the number of people that have joined you in rejecting God. And so we have to be careful when we say the ends justify the means, because we don't know. We don't necessarily know what the end really was. You got more people there, but do you really have more Christians there? That's the start. Now let's go over to 1 Corinthians. So we had read for us 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 10 through 15. And what you have is a very troubled church that has all sorts of trouble, all sorts of problems, all sorts of immaturity, spiritual issues. And the one that Paul decides to start off with is this issue between preachers. And the issue wasn't between preachers, but between the attitude of preachers. Paul is greater than Cephas, who's Peter, or Peter's greater than Apollos, or Apollos is greater than Paul. And so they're having this great division over who's the greatest preacher. And it's about who converts the most people. That's your basic, most reasonable argument they have, is Apollos is converting more people than Paul. And that's why Paul starts talking about the baptism. He says, were you baptized into Apollos? Were you baptized into Paul? And he says something really baffling at first. In verse 14, I thank God that I baptized none of you except Crispus and Gaius. What an odd thing to say. I'm so glad I didn't baptize any of you. I want you to notice, he doesn't say, I'm so glad none of you were baptized. He says, I'm glad I'm not a part of this. And he explains that in the next verse, because he says, so that no one would say you were baptized in my name. But the argument, the division is, who is most effective? They're the greatest preacher. So I want you to look at what then is stated in verse 17. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in cleverness of speech, so that the cross of Christ would not be made void. So here Paul gets back to his mission, and it's our mission as well. And our mission is not get people wet. It's not about how many people we convert. That's not our mission. Our goal, our desire, yes, we want to save as many people as possible. But our mission is not to go out and do whatever it takes to baptize people. If that was the case, Paul was wrong. And Apollos was better. Paul could have done things differently. He could have been more effective. He could have used the instrumental music. He could have used the church fair with the rides. He could have done all these various things to get people to come in. He could have used different language, trickery, all these things, if it really was just about baptizing people. But he says, that's not my goal. I wasn't sent to baptize people. What I was sent to do was to preach the gospel. And if what we do is something other than simply preaching the gospel, so let us say, like in the next phrase, we add cleverness of speech, and so now we're just trying to, through our great oration, trick people into becoming Christians, what have we done? And he says there at the very end of that verse, so that the cross of Christ would not be made void. The problem, brothers and sisters, is when the gospel is not enough, we nullify the gospel. Romans 1 and verse 16 says that I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation. If we really believe that, it's all we need. And if we need something more, then we're really saying the gospel does not have that power. It doesn't have the power to attract people. It doesn't have the power to convert people. It doesn't have the power to save people. Paul's not done. We're going to look at the first four chapters here really quickly, or at least a few verses in it. So he goes on in chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, and he explains this process again. He really hasn't stopped, and verses 18 through 31 is still going on the same things. But now chapter 2, verse 1. And when I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And in my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. And so here he goes on, and he's now talking about his method. And Paul's saying, I could have used a better method if what you mean is you want more results, more people. There's better methods for that. I could have done that. But at what cost? Previously, in verse 17 of chapter 1, he said it nullifies the cross. In this case, he says, but what do the people put their faith in? If the people become Christians because of me, who are they following? If it's because of my greatness and my method and my ideas and my concepts, they're not following God. They're following that person. And so in verse 5, he says, he does all these things. He doesn't use the methods of persuasive speech, of superiority of speech, of craftiness, so that your faith would not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. And so if people are coming to the church because they're getting food, If they're coming to the church because they're getting money, and I've seen churches that have done that. Have you seen that where they have like the special lucky chairs? You come to church and then everybody checks underneath their chair and you might have an envelope that has money in it. Personally, I would game that system. I would come in and before I sat down, I'd be underneath all the rows. So that's not going to work. But really, what have you got? Have you got people coming for Jesus? You've got people coming for music. You've got people coming for money. You've got people coming for food. You've got people coming for fun. Their faith isn't in God. It's in themselves. It's in your method. It's in what they want. So then Paul goes down, and if you go down in verse 12 and 13, he says, look, the message we have is so much better than anything else we could come up with, any other method we could develop. He says, now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, so that we may know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. And so Paul is saying, I'm not going to change the message, and I'm not going to change the method, because what I have is greatest. It is from God. So then we go over to chapter 3, and he argues that there's a problem with them focusing on Paul and them focusing on Apollos, and really in our case it would be on us focusing on our method too much, saying, well, if we'll just do this different thing, we'll have more people become Christians. He goes on in chapter 3, verse 5, he says, what then is Apollos and what is Paul? They're servants. Through whom you believed, even as the Lord gave opportunity to each one. I planted, Apollos watered, but God was causing the growth. So then neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but God who causes the growth. Now he who plants and he who waters are one, but each will receive his own reward according to his own labor. And there are several things to get from this passage, but the real main thing is this. When it comes to conversions, numbers, when it comes to how many people we bring to Christ, that's not up to us. We go out and we do the work. We go out and we spread the message. And if the world doesn't like the message, we've done our job. We've done what God asked us to do. What matters is us doing our part, not us saying, well, this isn't working, so we're going to change it. And so we're going to make it more appealing. We're going to make it more entertaining. We're going to find some other way to bring people in. Because the one who really converts, the one who really saves is God. It's up to Him. Our job is very simple. The world out there doesn't know the truth. We should teach it to them. That's it. Now they might accept it, and we will rejoice. And they might reject it, but we will still be rewarded. Because that's what he said there in verse 8. He who plants and he who waters are one, but each will receive his own reward according to his own labor. We will be rewarded for what the world considers failure. If we go out and we preach God's word and the world rejects it, we will still be rewarded. Even though the world might say, well, you're not growing, you don't have new numbers, you're failing. If we're doing the labor, we will still be rewarded. And the last thing I want to point out in regards to this is, when I say last thing, what I mean is we're on the last point of this slide. And this is the last slide. But I have other things I want to say. So chapter 4 and verse 6 says, now these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, so that in us you may learn not to exceed what is written, so that no one of you will become arrogant in behalf of one against the other. So here's this great debate is over who's the greatest preacher, and it's about who's the most effective. And he says, let's get down to it. Don't go beyond what is written, or else you will get into those fights. Don't start into your own methods, your own plans, and your own ways, or you will get into those fights over who's best. And you will have these issues of arrogance. And so for us, here's our plan. Here's our message. It was good enough then to take a teaching, a doctrine that was barely in existence and have it spread over the whole world in one generation. If it was good enough then, why is it not good enough now? Why do we need new methods and new plans and new ways of doing things? Stick to the method, stick to the message. It is good enough. Now, if I were to make the argument that the ends do justify the means and we should do whatever it takes, I would actually turn to a passage in 1 Corinthians to support that. And the passage I would turn to is later on in 1 Corinthians, and that's 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Verses 31 through 33, where he says, "Whether then you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many, so that they may be saved." And so one could easily say from this that he says, I will do anything it takes to save somebody. But I want you to notice that's chapter 10. He's already laid down the groundworks in chapter 1 through 4. And the groundwork was, I will not mess with the message. But what he's saying here is, I will not personally get in the way. I won't do something because I have the right to do it if it'll cost people their soul. He says something similar in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Starting in verse 19, he says, "For though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all so that I may win more. To the Jews I became a Jew so that I may win Jews. To those under the law as under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. To those who are without law, as though without law, though not being without the law of God, but under the law of Christ, so that I might win those who are without law. To the weak I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that I might by all means save some. I do all things for the sake of the gospel, so that I may become a fellow partaker of it." And a person, again, could look at this passage and he's saying he'll do whatever it takes to save, but that's not what he said. He said there's limitations. To those that are without law, I'll behave like I'm without law, but I am under law, and I will behave that way, because he mentions that I'm under the law of God. I will continue to follow the law of Christ. And notice what he also said in verse 23. "I do all things for the sake of the gospel." Think about that. As we strive to go out and teach, make sure that we're not undermining the very message we're supposedly upholding. Because that's what he was warning about. If we say it's not good enough, we need more, we need different methods, we're undermining God's word. And that's a very bad thing. Do you see what I mean? How many of you feel like, yes, let's go out and do something? Not exactly the persuasive sermon. However, in it was this hint that there is something of great importance for you. There is this message of the gospel. And the gospel really isn't that complicated. It's not that difficult for us to go out and to teach to other people. It's really pretty simple. Jesus, a man who came on this earth, was the Son of God, sent by God, did not sin, died for you. And God, in order to prove that that was the case, resurrected him on the third day. And now the question is, what will you do about that? Will you ignore this great gift? Will you ignore this great plan? Or will you recognize God's plan for you and dedicate your life to Him? And receive the forgiveness of sins, of the things you've done wrong, by being baptized into Jesus. Wow, that took what, a minute? It's not a complicated message. That's what we're supposed to go out and share. If there are any here who are not Christians, but you realize that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, we grant you an opportunity to become a Christian. We invite you to come forward. The front seats are empty. Tell us that you believe. Confess that your faith. And we'll have you baptized into Jesus this morning. If you're a Christian and you have fallen away, we encourage you to come back, to return to Him. And He will forgive you if you will confess your sins. Won't you come as we stand and as we sing?